We are going for liftoff in T-30.
This is the AstroPod, a podcast from Cambridge University and inthesky.org.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the AstroPod, the space science podcast from the Institute of Astronomy and Catholic Institute of Cosmology here in Cambridge. This month, once again, we'll be bringing you the latest news from the worlds of astronomy, astrophysics and cosmology. I'm Dominic Ford, and joining me again this month is Nicole Parvelek.
Hi, and welcome back. In this podcast, we'll be bringing you the largest structure ever discovered within the Milky Way. Plus, will mega constellations of satellites soon destroy the night sky for astronomers? In the past year, Elon Musk's company SpaceX has launched over 300 Starlink satellites. Perhaps thousands more will follow. We'll be looking into why so many astronomers are upset about it and look into the regulation which goes into such projects. And we'll be hearing about the strange bursts of radio waves, which theorists struggle to explain.
Bringing you the latest news from the world of astronomy, you're listening to the AstroPod.
The European Space Agency's Gaia spacecraft is surely one of the most remarkable telescopes of modern times. The resolution of its cameras is so high that it could resolve a human thumbnail at the distance of the Moon. And Gaia uses that stunning resolution to make remarkably detailed 3D maps of our Milky Way galaxy using an ingenious technique. It determines the distances to stars by observing how they're positioned in the sky change over time as the Earth moves around the Sun. Now, in January, a paper appeared in the journal Nature which used the latest data from Gaia to identify a huge structure called the Radcliffe Wave, which is made up of a stream of gas and stellar nurseries running right past the spot where the Sun lies. To find out more, I spoke to George Rebusso.
So today we have a very exciting discovery. We are going to talk about something that we didn't see before and that can challenge the knowledge of the structure of our galaxy, the Milky Way.
So what are the observatories that saw this thing?
Actually, very special observatories because they are in space. We are talking about two space missions. One is called Gaia and the other is Planck. Gaia is a European Space Agency mission, and it has been observing stars in our galaxy for the last 6 years, mainly measuring the positions, the distances, and the motion of our stars, basically building a 3D map of our Milky Way, and also, in a way, classifying the stars. So it's kind of doing a 3D census of our galaxy. While Planck is still a European Space Agency mission that happened in the past. And its main aim was to study the cosmic microwave background, which is the relict of the Big Bang, but also providing information on the distribution of gas and dust in the Milky Way. So what is this discovery? A team of astronomers from Vienna and Harvard universities cross-matched the data from Gaia and Planck, only a selected part of the sky, in particular a sample of local clouds, so close to the Sun, where there is a star formation, where we can see the stars are forming. So they selected these directions and also direction between these clouds to see if somehow these clouds were connected. So actually, using Gaia data for the stars in these clouds, the scientists discovered actually that there is a big structure in the Milky Way. It's quite close to the Sun, it's around 500 light years. And if we were outside the Milky Way and we could look top down, we could see this very long, quite narrow filament. But if we looked from the side, we see that actually it's not straight, it's actually wavy, T-shaped like a wave. And this could be a random structure, but actually further analysis using, for instance, the radial velocities of the stars, so how the stars move with respect to the Sun, shows that actually this is a coherent structure, so there is a physical reason why this is there. So this structure is called the Radcliffe Wave, And in honor of the Institute, a home base of the collaboration of the scientists that discovered the structure. So it is called Radcliffe Way, and it's quite big. It's around 2.7 kiloparsec, which is around 9,000 light years. And just to give you the idea of the size, is more or less, just a little bit less than a third of the radius of the Milky Way. So it's really big. And we actually can estimate the mass of this structure using the Planck data. And the estimate is around 3 million of the mass of the Sun, so quite big. And what is the origin of this structure? We don't really know for sure, it's not yet clear. There are many hypotheses. The most probable is that this is the result of large-scale gas accumulation. So this could be caused, for instance, for a shock front in one of the spiral arm of the galaxy. Or maybe it was because of gravity. The gas settled on the plane of the Milky Way and cooled there. So that's explain why there is this long and narrow filament of gas. But why it is wavy? Also that just hypothesis, but there has been some event that disturbed the cloud, because we see the structures also in other galaxies and also in simulation, and these are explained only by the presence of a perturbator. So it is also important to understand what could be this perturbator. An hypothesis is that the cloud crashed against a clump of dark matter and that caused the wave, kind of like a ripple in a pond when you throw a stone in it. And as I say, it's very important because we never seen it before. And the reason why we never seen it before is that, first of all, we didn't have the Gaia distances. These are very precise and they helped us to actually detect the structure. And also because it's quite close to us, so it's hard to see. And other consequences of these discoveries is that it challenges the existence of what we called the Gold Belt. This Gold Belt is a ring of stars in the Milky Way that was observed in the 19th century from an astronomer called Gould. And now we have seen that most of the stars and the associated clouds are associated with the Radcliffe Wave. And the belt can be explained simply as a projection effect. So we have seen this very new feature in our galaxy, and this will probably lead to a big revision of our understanding of the architecture of the gas in the solar neighborhood. And also this wave can be the framework to better understand how the molecular clouds form and evolve, and eventually how they are able to form stars.
That was Georgia Busso, who works on analysing Gaia data here at the Institute of Astronomy. And you can find all the details of that discovery in the journal Nature, where they were published on the 9th of January.
This is the AstroPod.
Now, if you read any popular astronomy magazine, you've probably heard of the Starlink satellites. They're just the first of a number of proposed mega-constellations of satellites, the term given to groups of thousands of spacecraft which orbit the Earth together in formations to provide internet and mobile phone signals around the world.
Now you might ask, why should that bother astronomers? Well, the problem is that these satellites have shiny solar panels. These reflect the sun's light as they pass overhead, and they shine so brightly that they are easily visible to the unaided eye. If one of those satellites passes in front of a sky area where a telescope is pointing, it could completely ruin whatever observation was being made. This could soon be very difficult for astronomers, since thousands more satellites are planned. So, how serious is the threat, and how are commercial ventures like this regulated? Where can astronomers go to raise their concerns? Dominic met up with astronomer Carlos Gonzalez and international relations expert Nikita Chu.
So Starlink is an enterprise launched by Elon Musk, trying to provide internet worldwide, particularly in poorly covered areas like rural areas and like places where infrastructure is not really good. And for this, they need a lot of satellites. The problem with these satellites is that they reflect the sun. They have solar panels, so they need the sun in order to function properly. and they reflect sunlight, and also they are intrinsically bright. They are metallic, so they reflect light. And this is bad for everyone looking at the sky because you can actually see them with the naked eye. But also it's much worse for telescopes, particularly because when you use a telescope, you will point at a place for a long-ish time, and you can very clearly see when one of these satellites crosses your line of sight, you can very clearly see the trace of this artificial satellite on your images. And I mean, it won't destroy your image, but particularly if you're doing science and you spend a lot of time, and time in large telescopes is precious. It's very hard to come by nights of observation. I mean, if you're looking at your science project and this is your PhD thesis and this is the only shot you have of observing this thing, and one of these satellites crosses by, it might be very bad for your science.
From reading the internet, I've heard various different people commenting either that it will be virtually impossible to take a picture of a night sky without these satellites interfering, or perhaps other people saying that most serious astronomy projects now take short exposures that they stack, and that with clever image processing, you could cut these satellites out. So how much of a problem do you think this really will be?
So it is a problem. We have ways around it. And as you say, one thing you can do, instead of taking a very long exposure where you're looking at the same place for an hour, what you do is you break it into like 10-minute bits, and then if you have to throw away one of the bits, then it's fine. You haven't lost the whole hour. But still, you have, or we have to think about this in terms of resources. So throwing those 10 minutes is time you're losing, essentially. And even if you can be very clever and just mask the satellite in your image and just lose a bit of your image, that is also resources you're losing. And this might be a problem now. But this is, as of now, I think there are a couple of thousand satellites in the sky. Starlink will add to those 2,000, at least 12,000 more. And probably this is not going to be the only company that will launch this kind of satellites. So it might become much more of a problem down the line in the future. And also these satellites, particularly Starlink, they use radio frequencies to communicate between themselves and with Earth. And for radio astronomers, this will be a really bad thing because this part of the spectrum that these satellites are using will not be usable for astronomy anymore, because essentially you will only see the radio signals coming from these satellites instead of seeing things that are beyond Earth.
Now, Nikita, I know that you have a background in international relations. Could you tell us a bit about the regulation and scrutiny that goes into companies that want to launch spacecraft?
At the international level, there are some international guidelines to give guidance to private sector how they could operate in the orbital environment and ensure that outer space resources are used in a responsible and sustainable manner. But keep in mind that international regulations or international policy or guidelines is very difficult to implement and to ensure 100% compliance. When there are violations, usually it will rely on some sort of dispute resolution mechanism to resolve that. And if there is no robust dispute settlement or resolution mechanism in place, then it could be quite difficult to ensure compliance. At the national level, states themselves could also make binding legislation to ensure the private sector comply to it. But even then, to my understanding, is there could still be non-compliance because it's quite difficult to verify violations. The commercial sector could go to consider registering in a place with less stringent regulations. So there are initiatives at both national and international level, but at the end of the day, it would be best if we could have a shared understanding, not just from the government, but also from the private sector, that the outer space environment is something that we should all responsibly share and use it in a sustainable manner.
In terms of astronomers who are currently concerned about commercial projects, is there any kind of forum that they can go to express their concerns?
So there are forums, like the astronomers can look into events organized by the United Nations Office for Outer Space Affairs to see if there are any presentation that they would like to make. And I think astronomers could make valuable contributions to the future development of the orbital environment. So I have to say that as a policy academic, I already try my best to be aware of concerns and priorities from different fields, particularly from engineering as well. But I was still quite surprised when the astronomy community react quite vocally about the first stage of the Starlink project. And I think that really only through intersectoral, interdisciplinary dialogue could we have the ability to kind of future-proof.
You talked about the finite resources that are available in space. How full are the possible orbits for spacecraft?
I think the most important thing we need to recognize is that at the moment there is no economically viable means to remove satellite in a time that we specifically desire. There are technologies being explored and developed by startups to remove satellites that are no longer operational, but it's not commercially common technology at this stage. So what it means is that we are launching all these space objects into the orbit, and there's no way for us to remove it. So the question of how full would the orbital environment become is that, it, according to a lot of experts, is already quite crowded. The question of if the orbit is going to become full is a more of a question of when. So it is going to happen considering the scale of commercialization of the space industry.
When we launch a spacecraft, how long does it stay up before it comes back down again?
So there are different major orbits, and if it is put into position in the LEO orbit, eventually the satellites would be subject to atmospheric drag and we enter Earth. But even for that, it could take years, if not decades. And if you send a satellite further away to geostationary orbit, then they will never come back to Earth. They are just going to stay there, even when they become not functional anymore, perhaps due to malfunctioning or as a result of running out of fuel. Then for those satellites, because they lost the link to ground control, then they would just stay there.
Looking ahead, would you say that you're optimistic that these kind of international dialogues will happen?
I think the dialogue has already happened in collaborating in space at the International Astronautical Congress. There has been suggestion of sharing of space debris tracking data between countries. I'm sure there would be other legislative or political concerns to overcome before that become a reality, but there has been ongoing discussions at the national and also international level. Am I optimistic? I hope for the best. I think there are academics like Carlos and you and myself who are concerned about it, and we talked about it, and hopefully we continue to raise awareness of the issue, and then we are able to convince policymakers to be concerned about it as well. Because one of the biggest challenge as a technology governance academic is that many times I have people telling me that, oh, we're too busy solving problems on Earth, we don't have time for issue in space, so it's not our priority. That's neglecting the fact that a lot of our socioeconomic activities actually rely on space technologies. So I don't like that argument. So there is a burden on academic to raise awareness that our daily life is intrinsically linked to the satellite infrastructure. And by paying attention to potentially catastrophic scenarios, we are actually not kind of, you know, putting aside problems on Earth. We are kind of, you know, employing a comprehensive approach in solving a shared use of resource problem.
I was talking there to Carlos Gonzalez and Nikita Tru, who works at the Space Engineering Research Center at the University of Southern California. You're listening to the Astropod with me, Dominic Ford, and with Nicole Parvelek.
Now, let's leave Earth and our Milky Way behind. Let's talk about mysterious bursts of radio waves. These bursts usually last no more than a few milliseconds, and they were named quite unimaginatively fast radio bursts. Usually these bursts are one-off events that don't repeat, but astronomers have recently found one curious example which produces repeated bursts. And it seems to lie within a nearby spiral galaxy. To find out more, Dominic spoke to Aybüke Yoldaş.
This is interesting in two aspects. One is that it's a fast radio burst, and we don't really know much about fast radio bursts. They are usually just one-off events, bright, very short duration radio signals. And this is one of them. But it is also interesting because this is one of the few that repeats these bursts, and it is the only one that is more or less has a regular periodic activity. So it's active for 4 days, and there is a 12 days of silence, and then it repeats this cycle of 16 days.
So this object actually has a very predictable cycle where you see the radio emission for a few days and then you don't for a few days.
It is, yes. The active periods, as far as we understand, are not that regular in itself, but yes, it has a predictable 16-day cycle.
Do we have any idea what could be causing this?
Yes, so there are some working theories. So one of the advantages of this one is that it happened in a nearby big spiral galaxy, so we can have more observations about it. And there are quite a few theories on what it can be caused by, and some of the most prominent ones involves either a magnetar or a binary system that involves a magnetar and a massive star.
So when you talk about a magnetar, physically, what is a magnetar?
So magnetars are compact objects. They are very fast rotating neutron stars with very high magnetic fields.
So very extreme physical environments here.
They are, definitely.
And I guess that would explain why they're producing this radio emission that we can see from a vast distance.
Most likely, yes, but we still don't know the details. And this is the only event that the astronomers have observed so far. So we definitely need more of these events to further the current theories.
You mentioned that this object was seen in a nearby spiral galaxy. Is that typical of the sort of environments where we've seen these radio bursts in the past?
We don't really know, actually, because so far over 70 of fast radio burst events has been observed, but only 4 of them were localized. That is, we only know where they come from for only 4 of these events. The 4, we know that they are coming from other galaxies, but not all of them are coming from big spiral galaxies like this one.
I guess the fact that they're so short-lived means that it's quite hard to pin down where the radiation is coming from.
Yes, exactly, because they only last for a few milliseconds, so it's difficult to obtain more information about them.
So what next? Do we start taking very high-resolution images of this galaxy to try and see what the object is that produces this periodic emission?
Well, unfortunately, there are no other signals in radio or other wavelengths coming from these sources. So despite observations, we don't really have much information. But obviously, this particular one has an advantage of being nearby. So I suppose with future big telescopes and space telescopes like JWST can give us more information about these events.
That was Aybüke Yoldaş, who works here at the Institute of Astronomy. And you can find all the details of that discovery in the journal Nature, where it was published on the 9th of January by Benito Makota and his colleagues.
That's all we have for you this month, but Dominic and I will be back next month. In the meantime, if you want to find out more about the Astropod, you can find all the details on our website, bit.ly/theastropod. Until next time, goodbye!
The Astropod is brought to you from Cambridge's Institute of Astronomy and Kavli Institute for Cosmology. If you've got any questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you. You can email astropod@ast.cam.ac.uk or find us on Twitter @Cambridge_astro.